presented to the media. We have a kind of a lengthy presentation from Treasury, which will consist of two parts. Firstly, the two bills, and we have suggested that, you know, they are rather lengthy presentations. They are draft bills, and so this is the process that will be leading to it being returned with all of the comments to Treasury for them to table the bill, which will then be considered by ourselves. But the bill that will be tabled, if I understand it, Momo, would be basically accommodating and where possible and where appropriate the amendments that come through this process.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it will be a kind of a lengthy presentation. We're inviting members to, as the presentation goes along, Elephant Dikadedi, just, and there's something if you just want some more information on or clarity on, don't wait till the end. You can interrupt them, we discuss with them and just say, well, could you kindly elaborate on this point? So that's how we'll approach it. So if that's okay with you, Momo and team, it's right over to you.
Well, thanks, Chair. And I think it's good always just to start, as you're doing, Chair, to just to explain the process, because it is different from other bills, and therefore there's always confusion. I think we're starting with the technology. But you do have this. But Chair, just to say, there's six of us, three from Treasury, Yanga, Chris, and myself, and then Franz, Katinka, and Brunel. I don't know why Katinka is sitting at the back, there's ample space there, but she protests a lot.
It's only the admiral who's supposed to be in the back. She doesn't take the shells as much as anyone else.
Chair, we've broken up. So just to help you, as you said, the way to go, as members would know, there's two bills that we're looking at. First is the Tax Laws Amendment Bill, and secondly is the Tax Admin Laws Amendment Bill. For the TALAB, we've broken it into seven parts. We could take questions after two or three, if you like, because we can certainly differentiate them as personal and corporate and the rest, if you like, and the TALAB, you can take in one go. I think just to get through the overview of the process, the minister, I haven't got my improved version here, okay, the minister announces these bills in the budget, so we try and not make any tax proposals when it on the other 364 days. Okay, we just do it on budget day. With the leap year also, then 365 days if we don't make tax announcements. There are rare occasions when there's a tax avoidance measure, we would go out and make a special announcement to say, we're just warning you, be aware of the scheme, and from this date on, if any such schemes take place, we will legislate that it will be illegal. And the bill is it's retrospective to that bill, but that's how we intend to do it. So we published the draft rates and monetary amounts and amendment of revenue laws bill on budget day. And as you know, these bills are not tabled, so they're always draft bills. And I think, as the Chair said, we only table these bills after the hearings are completed, and then we table the formal bill. And we try and reduce the possibility of changes thereafter, but as members would be aware, we've certainly made changes to bills even after they table. And it's quite a procedure to go through. I had hoped that on the money laws, the procedure to amend money laws bill, that some of this might be taken into account, but let's deal with it in a separate process. So today we just got the two other bills, because the rate bill deals with rates and some of and specials and urgent issues like the health levy, which we will kind of give you an update on at the end, but we're not dealing with that issue today, just to remind members. So we are only going to deal with the Talab and Taleb bill, Taleb and Talab bill. And these, of course, contain the more complex technical amendments that are related, changing the base, etc. I should add that the other outstanding issues that we will be coming up with is we have said that we'll be publishing the carbon tax book that will be coming up at some point. It's on the schedule. And for example, as we've done Twin Peaks, there's often a money bill or levies bill that comes. Those are pretty short bills normally, and bills like that would come to you separately from this process often. So, Chair, I think just to remind members, the reason why today you have two bills is that the Constitution forces us, to split the bills, because we've got to literally take the bill that the Constitution says is a money bill, as a Section 75 bill, as a Section 76-7 money bill, and then everything else, the admin issues, we have to deal with as Section 75, which the Constitution doesn't allow us to have substantive admin issues in the money bill, so we have to actually split it, which is an artificial split, but that's the reason why we are splitting. And that's the reason why, because it's an artificial split, we take these as one round. And you know, if you looked at any of these bills separately, I think that they would be difficult to understand without seeing the impact in the other bill. So we as a department, given that these are draft, put this out. So we published these, I think, on July the 19th. So we also take comments. And we try and sync it with the parliamentary process, but most years we don't really succeed. So you'd be putting out the advert now for hearings. It will have a different date. But we, in effect, take the later date then for submissions. And thereafter, I mean, even as we get the comments, we start talking to stakeholders, people who have sent us their comments and clearly have detailed issues. We often need to sit in workshops just to understand their point of view and look at what the issues are. And then, Chair, what happens is once you've had your hearings, which we hope you'll do it later this month.
I know the hearing date has been set for the 29th.
Okay.
And set for a whole day on the 29th.
So once you have that, and we've processed all these responses, we come back sometime in September with what we call a response document that says these are the comments we received on these clauses, and on clause 3, this was what we received, this is our response to it. And that's discussed, and once there's hopefully some consensus in the committee, because we try and get consensus, we then revise the actual bill, and the bill is then formally tabled. So that's the process that we'll be going through. And then October we table, and then you have a pretty quick process in Parliament then to approve it. These bills generally have to be passed by the end of the year, otherwise we could be creating a kind of crisis where we start owing revenue to taxpayers because of measures not being adopted, for example. Because a lot of these measures, less in the TLAB and TALAB issues, but certainly in the rates bill, the rates already take effect, and then we have to claw back if, for whatever reason, this was not accepted by Parliament. So, Chair, the first issue we deal with in the bill itself, and Yanga will talk through it, but You'll recall that last year we had a measure that says whenever we amend, we announce a bill, a change in the rate, that we can actually collect the money. Now, it's been less of a problem before. Like with PIT, you generally change the brackets to take into account fiscal drag so that, in effect, it's a lower rate for everyone, even if you don't change the rate. So that's easier to do because you're just collecting less. The problem comes when you increase the tax rate, like we have this year, to 45%, that in the past it's been, hold on, how can you collect more? Now, though we don't think that, we think legally we could have, but we wanted to make sure by putting in a provision which allows us to withhold more based on Parliament adopting the higher amount. And we found this year that we still didn't cover every tax because as we surprised the market, when we raised the dividend tax, the withholding on the dividends tax, that doesn't have a similar provision. So this is not a this year issue, but we want to introduce this in the event these things happen. But Yana, you want to go through it?
Yes. Last year we made changes for income tax, a similar amendment for income tax, but we did not include the withholding taxes. So this year when we increased the withholding tax rate from 15 to 20 and during the public hearings on the rates bill, then there was a view that the, how can you increase the rate before the amending legislation is promulgated. But we, on response to the Parliament, you said that throughout the world and including South Africa, that's what we normally do. But in order to legalize this so that we are not caught in the same argument in the following years, we are proposing an amendment in all the tax acts for the minister to increase all the withholding taxes on the date of the announcement and the legislation, and subject to Parliament passing the legislation within 12 months after that announcement. And this amendment, this proposed amendment is similar to the current amendment we have on the Customs and Excise Act and the amendments that were made last year in 2016 on other tax, not withholding taxes. Yes.
Okay, the next section is on personal income taxes. The first one is the repeal of, it's called Section 10102 of the Act. This is an exemption for income on foreign earned remuneration. So just to give a bit of background, in 2001, South Africa moved to a residence-based source, i.e., so we'll tax people based on your tax residency, not on only if you earn the income in South Africa. There was originally an exemption in there for SA officers and crew who were outside of South Africa for 183 days. But in 2001, when we brought in the residence base, this was extended to employment income of any residents, so not just crew, any residents. If they worked outside of South Africa for 183 days, where 60 of those days were continuous, but not for public servants. So since 2000, it was, we think it was quite a generous exemption then, but it has been in place for a long time. Since 2001, things have changed quite a bit, especially in terms of double tax agreements. So double tax agreements that you sign with countries make sure that people aren't taxed twice. So it determines who gets the first taxing right, in effect. So in most of the double tax agreements that we signed, if you work in a state for less than 183 days, less than, then if you're a South African tax resident, but you work overseas for less than 183 days, you're still seen, according to that DTA, as being South Africa as the first taxing right, according to that double tax agreement. If I say anything wrong, France and Yanga can correct me, please. But if you work for longer than 183 days in that foreign country, you are seen as a tax resident there first, primarily, but it does not preclude South Africa's right to tax that individual. But South Africa must be able to allow for a foreign tax credit for the taxes already paid. So that's what the DTA has put together, and a lot of those have been signed. I think over 78 have been signed with other countries since 2001. So in that explanatory memo to that Revenue Laws Amendment Act in 2000, It anticipated the possible abuse of this exemption. So it said, and I quote, "The effect of this relief measure will be monitored to determine whether certain categories of employees abuse it to earn foreign employment income without foreign taxation." So what we have found is that South African tax residents are going overseas, they're working, and it's leading in some instances to a case of double non-taxation. So if you work in a country where there's no income tax, you won't pay any income tax there, but you also won't pay any income tax here. So you're not paying tax anywhere. We don't think this is correct. It also creates inequities because state-owned entity employees are not applied. This exemption doesn't apply to them. So if they were working overseas for 300 days in the year, they would still be taxed in full in South Africa. So it creates these issues. Because it's a 183-day exemption, we're also seeing a lot of cases where people are intentionally going just past that level. So they're going to 185 days or 190 days in order for all the income that they have earned while they work overseas to then be free from tax within South Africa. So the proposal was that we will repeal this exemption in its entirety. As a result, South African tax residents would be subject to tax on foreign employment income earned in respect of services rendered. So the existing architecture, because we also said the tax credits will apply. So if you go and you work overseas, but you pay tax there, even though you are taxed in South Africa, we will give a credit for the taxes that you have paid overseas. So there won't be cases of double taxation at all. We do have DTA, so there won't be double taxation, and the six quat is available for tax credits for tax that has been paid offshore. So we are hoping that the automatic exchange of information with other revenue authorities will strengthen the enforcement of this going forward. Okay, so there's been quite a lot spoken about this, and we've got a lot of comments already on it. Just to give you some of the members, some of the information on why we are doing this, and just to clear up some issues, this isn't a completely new system. So at the moment, if you earn income from working less than 183 days in another country, you would still be taxed on that foreign income. If you were getting income through an independent contract in another country, even if you work for 330 days in another country, you would still be taxed on that income in South Africa. So the tax this exemption only applies to foreign remuneration for working more than 183 days. So this is not a completely new system. SARS already deal with six quat credits, which they need to give to people who have paid tax in other countries when this exemption doesn't apply. If you are not a South African tax resident anymore, you won't be affected. So if you have moved offshore, have told SARS that you are non-tax resident, you won't be affected by this. So the whole point and the difficulty around this is that it all comes down to what is tax residency, so how you determine what is tax resident. So we have an ordinarily resident test, and it's not defined in the Income Tax Act, and Yanga and Frank can also help me on this, but it is usually related to case law. So do you have a permanent home? Do you have social business connections? Is your family still here? There are all these considerations that are taken into account whether to determine whether you're ordinarily resident, or there is a five-year time requirement, 91 days for each of the preceding 5 years and this year of assessment, and more than 915 days in total. So these are tax residency tests. So I think the first thing to clear up with everybody is that this is not based on citizenship. So a lot of people say, oh, I'm going to give up my passport straight away, and it's not based on citizenship. It's based on tax residency, which is very different.
And therefore, even if you give up your citizenship, you can still be tax resident in South Africa. And it also differs from what's understood as immigration as well, where you don't give up your passport. So there's many types of non-residency and residency, and we apply the tax test.
Yes, I think the big thing is for people to be careful about make any rash decisions on this. Obviously, this is a draft proposal, and we must think it, but there certainly is a lot of confusion over citizenship and tax residency in relating to this proposal. I'll be very quick. This is a little bit of data on where do people go when they leave the country, just so that we can see who will be affected and where they are. You can see Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Lesotho, Botswana are the top four African destinations. Australia, the UK, United States, and New Zealand are the top four overseas destinations. So if we were to just look at those top four overseas destinations, how do they treat foreign employment income? If we were in Australia, the UK, United States, or New Zealand. So if you go to Australia, and I've got their website there so everybody can go and have a look. If you're an Australian tax resident for tax purposes, you tax on your worldwide income, including foreign employment income. And how do you determine if someone is a tax resident in Australia? It's a reside test, which looks generally at whether the individual lives in Australia. And it looks at things such as the intention and behavior of the person, family and business ties, location of assets, social and living arrangements. So it's very similar to our ordinarily resident test. Okay? If it's not met, then they look at the domicile test. So if you're in the country for more than 183 days, you become a resident. So what does this mean? This means that if a person works overseas, even if it's for 365 days of the year, but they're still an Australian tax resident, the full amount of their employment remuneration will be added to taxable income, obviously subject to tax credits for any taxes they pay. So in effect, what is our proposal? Our proposal is in effect mirroring this Australian example. This is not some crazy idea that no other country does. This is exactly the same as what's done in Australia. If you go to the United Kingdom, residents normally pay UK tax on all their income, so you're automatically resident, again, if you spend more than 183 days there. But it doesn't mean you're automatically non-resident if you don't spend 183 days there. So you're only automatically non-resident if you spend fewer than 16 days in the UK, or you work abroad full-time and spend fewer than 91 days in the UK, which are no more than 30 were spent working. So if you don't do that, then there is a sufficient ties test, which again is family members, accommodation, etc., similar to our ordinarily resident. So this is slightly different. So this is a bit different to Australia. Here, if you spend less than 16 days in the UK, you're immediately seen as non-resident. Okay? So in effect, we have a 183-day exemption, 183-day test exemption. This is having a 349-day exemption. So it's extending that exemption way out, not way past 183 days. But it is different to Australia. They do have a non-domicile regime, which is completely different. And this is for if you have a permanent home outside of the UK. And there you only pay tax on amounts repatriated back into the UK. So their system is quite complicated. But it does have a few more of the exemption and would be seen as a bit softer as our proposal. In the United States, what do they do? This is interesting because this is based on citizenship, not on tax residency. So if you have a green card, you will be taxed regardless of how long you've been outside of the US or any other issues. So you need to be out, but they do have an exemption. But it is based on citizenship. But their exemption is if you spend more than 330 days outside of the US, then you only pay income on amounts above $100,800. Okay, so they also have an exemption, but only if you're outside of their country for a long period of time. But they also have a threshold of $100,000. But if you earn income in another country and you were there for less than 330 days, you would pay tax on that amount. And all you need to do is to be citizens. So you could be in another country for 15, 20 years, and you would still need to pay tax in the US. New Zealand, if you're a New Zealand tax resident, you tax on your worldwide income. Again, it looks at a permanent place of abode, which is very similar to your residency test here, your ordinarily resident test. And it includes, you must also pay tax on foreign employment income. So it's exactly the same as Australia, so again, this matches with what the draft TLAB is proposing. Those are the countries. There are another couple of countries which do exactly what we're proposing, Canada, Germany. So this certainly isn't something that is not seen in other countries around the world. But it does have very big implications. This is just a quick chart to show the different types of income and what the effect will be. The bottom line is the net income you receive after tax if you pay tax in South Africa. The next line up is that if you work for 184 days and you receive 50% of that income which wasn't taxed, i.e. you were working in a no-tax jurisdiction like the Middle East or in Dubai, UAE, etc. And then the top line is if 100% is worked offshore where there's no tax. So you see there's very big differences in net income. If you look at the next chart, the bar chart, this shows the potential implications are extremely large, which is why obviously we're getting a lot of responses on these issues. If you were earning a million rand, adjusted for exchange rates, in let's say the Dubai where there's no tax, at the moment you don't pay anything, but according to this proposal we're saying that you now need to pay an extra 315,000 rand. So it's a very big change in tax liabilities. If you remain a tax resident, but you're working offshore in Dubai. So it's got very big cliff effect, very large impact. If you became non-SA tax resident, i.e. if you formalised your affairs and you told SARS that you were no longer resident and you weren't resident according to the ordinarily resident test, then these tax charges wouldn't apply. The next chart is just to show, because what would happen now is we're talking about Dubai in the Middle East, but what about people in Australia or the UK or the US, which apparently are higher taxed countries? So this is an interesting chart, and it gives it another point. But basically it's showing the difference in tax paid compared to South Africa if you were in those other countries. The bottom line is if you were considered to be a non-resident in Australia, in effect that means you'd pay more tax in Australia than you would here, and then this wouldn't affect you all the way up to 1.5 million rand. Because you'd be paying more tax, you wouldn't need to pay any additional tax here. But the next line, the grey line, is in the UK. So what this is saying is that if you're in the UK and you were earning 1 million rand in rand terms, in effect, you would still need to pay an extra 25,000 rand to SARS. So you would need to make a top-up. And the reason for that is that we have a more progressive income tax schedule than the United Kingdom. So if we were going to tax your worldwide income, you would pay tax in the UK, and then we would allow that to be a credit, but you would still need to pay a little bit more tax in South Africa than you do currently. At the moment, you wouldn't pay anything if you worked fully abroad. If you were considered to be a tax resident in Australia, you would need to pay more. You'd have to pay 50,000 rand there or thereabouts on 1 million rand. Extra to SARS if you were working over there, and in the US you have to pay about 100,000 rand on 1 million. So this is showing, and I think it's a good point to show, that we have a very progressive income tax structure. Even though our top marginal rates are the same, for example, as in the UK, you get to that top rate a lot quicker. So it's very progressive, so you actually pay more tax here on the income, but according to this repeal, you would then need to make top-up payments to SARS. So what are the implications? I mean, we tried to look at how many people this would impact. If we look at tax returns, now, every individual who's a South African tax resident who's working offshore, they should be declaring that income in full. So that income should be declared to SARS in full, and then they should be claiming the 10102 exemption so that no tax is paid. Now, in 2014-15, there were 5,109 individuals who declared non-taxable foreign remuneration. So obviously, people aren't declaring that amount. And they might think, oh, well, we didn't need to because it wasn't taxed. But it's difficult for us because then we don't see how many people, but obviously there are more people than 5,109 who pay. That there are more people. Very good.
We already have a Facebook group with over 8,000 members who are resisting this. So that implies to me there are at least 3,000 people who are either resisting this out of pure disinterest or because they're directly impacted, I suspect the second.
No, and I think that's the problem. So, I mean, if you look at immigration statistics, a lot more people have immigrated. Well, that's the problem, sorry, Yanga. It's not formal. We don't know if they've formally immigrated for tax residency purposes, but a lot more people have left the country, for example, from stats, SA statistics and other statistics. So if you just look at how many expats are in the UK or in Dubai, you know, the numbers are a lot larger than this, and I'm pretty sure that not all of them have immigrated for tax residency purposes or are no longer tax residents. So we think it's a lot more, but agreed, we don't have any empirical firm evidence on that.
So
So we'll withdraw the word obvious. But I think just to bring another complexity in the South African situation, like when France was pointing out to us, and hopefully he'll come in. So you know, we've been doing a lot of thinking of, you know, when we look at the exchange control system, there too, I mean, the one issue that I've had is it still has a notion of immigration. And from what I can see, it's the only bit where we talk about emigration, okay? But, you know, when you emigrate, as we said, you can still be a South African citizen and still be tax resident in South Africa, okay? I mean, these concepts don't necessarily all coincide. So, for example, the issue even when we deal with exchange controls is, does this concept actually make sense? Because like Chris says, in some instances you declare that, especially if you've got assets and you want to take assets out. But if you're young, you become a professional, you probably don't have much in the way of assets yet, except for what you might inherit. The chances are that you're not going to tell government, look, I'm emigrating. You just go, you work in the UK, you come back then, whatever. So that's why, I mean, these things, I think they're literally impossible to determine exactly. It's only because there's an impact from a tax perspective, there's an impact with exchange control that people tell government, because you can retain your citizenship or leave it or let it lapse or whatever. So these concepts, I think, are different concepts, and it's a whole big area to look into. But as we get into the era of double non-taxation, in a sense at the extreme, that these issues are coming up in the world, and with the exchange of information provisions kicking in September. Okay. Yes, the automatic exchange. I think it's also easier now for these provisions to come in effect. Sometimes you get bizarre outcomes, like Chris talked about US. I mean, the former mayor and now the minister of, they don't say foreign affairs, Boris Johnson in the UK, was born, I think, he's lived all his life in the UK. He had US citizenship, and he sold his house in the UK. And the capital gains, I think, didn't apply in the UK for the primary residence, but the US then said he was liable to pay tax on that. He had to then, he actually gave up his citizenship in the US thereafter, so that he's not liable for future taxes. So you've got a pretty draconian system in the US, both with him and with companies when they, make their profits overseas. When they repatriate, they are supposed to pay a 35% tax. So
I'll just be very quick. I mean, this is...
We spend a lot of time on this, but let's maybe take questions as soon as you finish.
Yeah, I mean, just to... Just quickly, I mean, on the potential implications. So if you become non-tax, SA tax resident, you need to pay capital gains tax on your worldwide assets. And I think a lot of the comments are pointing to the fact there are people who've left, they've been gone for 15 years, but they've never told SARS that they're non-tax residents. So I think they're now worried that if they suddenly come forward and say, we don't want to be tax residents because they still want to earn income, their remuneration while they are overseas for it not to be taxable, then they're going to suddenly face capital gains tax on their worldwide assets, so you might get those comments. There will be people that will say, we're then going to move away from South Africa and reduce the tax base. What they might not say is that there are a lot of people offshore on net contracts, especially in the Middle East. So if you have people from the UK, the US, Australia working, say, for an engineering firm, they'll be on net contracts. So the employer will settle the tax liability. Those people, if there is a South African citizen on a net contract, that employer should then still settle that tax liability and it won't affect their position. It might affect the competitiveness of South African employees offshore, but in those people, there won't be an impact on those people in those jobs, and the tax will be paid by the foreign employer. In effect, it will be putting them on the same level as expatriates from Australia, UK, US, etc. So those are the issues. There's going to be a lot of, talk about it, but we wanted to provide you with some additional background on it. Bargaining councils,
okay, thank you, Chair. With regard to bargaining council, it came to government attention that some bargaining council have not been deducting pay as you earn from a large number of members in respect of holiday, sick pay, and end of the year payments. Others have also not been paying income tax in respect of the returns generated from investments of the bargaining council. And we found that this non-compliance extends back to a number of years, more than 5 years. And we had consultation with the Department of Labor because these are government bargaining council regulated by Section 28 of the Bargaining Council Labor Relations Act. So we had consultation with the Department of Labor, and the Department of Labor told us that, yes, we know that ignorance of the law is not a defense, but they were not aware. And if we could impose higher penalties for non-compliance, there would be a risk of those bargaining councils closing down. And also, let's say that if they never deducted PAYE, and then you go after the member who received the income without PAYE deduction, some of the members are dead, some of them are no longer working, who were the members of the bargaining council. So it will also be difficult to follow through to the process of withholding PAYE. So after the consultation with the Department of Labor, we proposed in the budget a relief for bargaining council. So now we're spelling out the relief in the TLAB to say that those non-bargaining council who have not been compliant, only those who have not been compliant, those who are compliant are not going to get the relief, will be required to pay 10% of the levy. We're going to have a levy of the total PAYE that should have been withheld on those payments to the members. And then the period, and also if they did not pay income tax, they're going to pay 10% levy of the income tax that they would have paid on the growth. And then it's only limited for the period of 5 years, from 1 March 2012 to 28 February 2017. Why 5 years? 5 years is the stage in which it's linked to the period for record keeping in terms of the Tax Administration Act. And then what the bill proposes that the non-compliant bargaining council must submit to SARS on 1 September 2018 in order to benefit from them. They should submit and pay on 1 September 2018. And it's important to note that this is the first and the last relief. If bargaining council did not come forward on 1 September 2018, then they will be assessed, higher penalties will be imposed, and then they'll be subject to test. They won't be subject to this levy if they did not come forward on that day.
Chair, this is an important provision to put forward because while certain they should have been complying, it's like the special VDP for bargaining council. Frankly, some of them will go under, and I think just in terms of the labor relations system, we don't want the tax system to become the reason for some of these structures not continuing. So I think this mechanism is to get their affairs right, but you should be just aware that there were problems here that we had to address this year.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just need some clarity. You're talking about a bargaining council. Are you just talking about the employees of the bargaining council or the members of the bargaining council who are affected by the bargaining council agreements? Because surely the employer is not the bargaining council in most cases. The bargaining council employs very few people, so the impact really should be very small.
It's the members of the bargaining council, because what happens, those contributions made were paid to the bargaining council on behalf of the member by the employer of the member. and maybe no tax was deducted, so meaning that tax has to be deducted and payment by the bargaining council to the member. So it's members of the bargaining council.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not setting very hasty. Until you find your
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, I just need to, I mean, I've been an employer in a bargaining council situation. At no stage did the employee's tax get transferred to the bargaining council. It was paid by the employer directly to SARS or receiver revenue, whoever it was at the time. So there should be no problem there. Are you suggesting that there are some employers who deduct the tax from the employee, pay it to the bargaining council, and then the bargaining council didn't pay it across?
No, it's not that scenario. No, it's not that scenario. It's the amount that is paid by the bargaining council to the member of the bargaining council.
So, I mean, there's some scenarios where the employer didn't withhold tax. So the employer makes a contribution on behalf of the employee to the bargaining council, for example, a sick pay fund. And then the bargaining council pays the money to the employee when that employee is sick. And no tax was deducted. So no tax was deducted going to the bargaining council, and no tax was deducted going to the employee. So in effect, no tax took place at all. So the employee is getting sick pay without any tax happening. And the same for holiday pay and others, which should have been taxable.
I'm sorry, it's your neighbor. I think it's better...
Okay, the next one is on 7C. So last year we put in anti-avoidance provisions to say that if somebody gave an interest-free loan to a trust, because the people were using interest-free loans to trust to avoid estate duty, what we found out that as soon as we did this, people were putting a company in between the person and the trust to break the link. So in effect, they were making an interest-free loan, but via a company or from a, you know, via a company to the trust. So it was in effect breaking the link of our anti-avoidance provisions. So what we're trying to do here is we're trying to say that we will actually include circumstances where there is a company involved in the middle between a loan from an individual to a trust, and that trust is a connected person to that individual. Is that okay, Daniel? Okay. The next one is on employee-based share-based schemes. So this was also an amendment we did last year to stop individuals using employee-based share schemes where they could pay out money to the individual that was taxed at a lower rate. The issue here was slightly technical. It was that in the 8th schedule for capital gains tax, it was in effect being included in the 8th schedule for capital gains tax, but it was also being included in the amount that we were then taxing according to this anti-avoidance provision. So this tries to clarify the interaction so that it will apply only in one instance, either in the H schedule or there. Is that correct? Yeah. The next amendment is on exemption for employer-provided bursaries to learners with disabilities. This actually comes from suggestions that were made from the committee to us. So we agreed with those suggestions, and we have now increased those exemptions quite considerably. So this is to say that if an employer provides a bursary to an employee or a relative of their that employee, they're up to a certain level, that bursary won't be seen as a fringe benefit, i.e. they won't have to pay additional tax on top of the bursary that they receive. And we've increased the eligibility threshold for employees from 400 to 600,000 and the bursaries from 15 to 20,000, and I think we've done that in the rates. Did we do that in the rates for younger?
Yes.
And then, yeah, and then now this exemption is to provide higher levels for those to accommodate learners with disabilities. So it was put forward that learners with disabilities have higher education costs, so then in effect they need higher bursaries in order to pay for the specialized services that they require. So we're allowing higher fringe benefits exemption for those learners with disabilities. And it goes from So there will be a new level of 30,000 Rand per annum for the mandatory limit, and up to 90,000 for NQF levels 5 to 10, so for higher levels. Okay, another amendment we are doing is on retirement funds. So we had received some submissions that they were individuals and consumers would like additional flexibility when they reach retirement. So 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we made an amendment that said if you get to your retirement date with an employer, you don't have to take an annuity then. The law at the time was saying if you got to your normal retirement date with an employer, in effect you'd be forced to take an annuity. You'd have to take an annuity with two-thirds and you could take a one-third lump sum. We changed the law a few years ago to say that you don't have to take the annuity. You can keep the money in the fund and in effect you can elect to take the annuity at any point later on. It's to give people more flexibility. If they want to continue working, if they want to consult, they can do it without being forced to start retirement in effect. From that, they then said, we don't have much flexibility because it's within the same fund and it might be with an employer fund. And the employer fund isn't used to dealing with people who have now left their employment and you can't transfer it. So this amendment is saying if you get to that position where it's after retirement but you haven't wanted to take the annuity, we'll allow you to transfer that amount to a retirement annuity fund. So in effect they can take it now out of their employer and put it into a retirement annuity fund so that they can then deal with that administrator and with that company and then take the annuity at a later date. So it's trying to give them additional flexibility. We didn't do it to preservation funds because in preservation funds you're allowed a one-off withdrawal and you didn't want people to get to retirement, then move it to a preservation fund and then take everything as cash. So that's why it's only for retirement annuity funds. We've also allowed, there's a special provision in the Act for more generous tax treatment for pre-March 1998 retirement fund benefits. There are still some of these amounts within the system, and they were allowed one transfer where they could still be tax-free. We're just proposing that they're now allowed one additional transfer so that they can now move their funds once more, and it will still remain tax-free, or according, not tax-free, but according to the more generous formula for pre-March 1998 public sector funds. So it's allowing one more transfer of those funds. There was also another simplification that we would like to make. In the current law, there is a 12-month limit on joining newly established pension or provident funds. So in the income tax, it says a member can join the fund, but only for the next 12 months. And industry were finding that they had some employees who were saying, well, we actually want to join, but then they weren't allowed to because they were offered to join more than 12 months ago. And this provision was restricting them. We think it would be fine to simplify it so that those employees can still join at any time in the future. And then lastly, on the retirement reform provision, we went to NEDLAC to discuss options on annuitization for Provident Fund members. It is supposed to come into effect on 1 March 2018, but we had said with this committee that we would discuss this within NEDLAC to try and get agreement on it. We had discussed how in NEDLAC we presented, and it was discussed how the comprehensive social security paper was slightly delayed. There is a task team in NEDLAC on comprehensive social security where the annuitization for Provident Fund members is part of that task team. That is still at a relatively early stage. We put forward an option to NEDLAC that we could postpone this for one more year. The other options were to go ahead with this proposal on 1 March 2018. Both Labour and business were supportive of it postponing the implementation of annuitization for Provident Fund members from 1 March 2018 to 1 March 2019. We still want to be very strong on this. We can't let this just continue, but we did believe that it was reasonable to allow this delay due to the delay in the discussion of the comprehensive social security development.
Chair, you were not in this committee at the time, but this was a big issue where we wanted to give everybody the benefit of annuitization. But we obviously link that because we give them a benefit, which is a tax deduction on the contribution. So currently there are members in the Provident Fund who are getting the tax deduction but not annuitizing. That has to end, but like Chris has said, the discussions in NEDEC started later, no fault of the other parties, because we in government could not provide the social security paper up front, well, as soon as we had hoped. But that was released now last year, towards the end of last year, so now there is sufficient time to complete these discussions. We're still not touching the big issues of preservation, let me say, which is another big issue. And I think when you see how times are tough currently, what the impact of not preserving, I think, means for people who are losing their jobs and so on. So I think it's still, you know, a very important issue. I actually think it's quite, if anything, I wish we had been accused of being reckless by not having these measures sooner on preservation, because the longer we allow preservation, I think the vulnerability of people when they retire is actually increasing, and I do believe it's you know, times are tough, and you see how what impact this has on people, and by government being tough on people whilst they're contributing and working to save for their retirement and make it obligatory, I think is an important public issue that we need to talk about, but it's not for today.
Okay, lastly on personal income taxes, the deduction for contributions to retirement funds, there were some technical issues which were leading to assessed losses because it was under Section 11, which only deals with deductions from carrying on of a trade. But you can make contributions to a retirement fund which might not necessarily be for only carrying on of a trade. So we've put it in its own provision to get rid of those issues, and we've tried to clean up some of the taxable capital gains issues in there. So it's slightly technical. It's not a change in policy. We think it's technical, but it will stop the it will stop certain cases of leading to assessed losses which shouldn't arise from a contribution to a retirement fund.
Chair, I would suggest we just then take any further questions, because then we move on to the business taxes. Because I think there's a lot in the personal, as you see, and though there's been questions for clarification, I think.
I think we have asked a couple of questions.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, yeah. I think it's working. Let's just go back to the withholding tax on dividends. Are you guys now saying that that implementation prior to parliamentary agreement was illegal? No, saying that. Okay. So, all right. Okay. So what are the real implications in terms of what you're proposing to change now? Is that going to be backdated to? Anyway, I'm not sure I'm asking the question well, but I think, Moma, you understand what I'm trying to say. In terms of this whole tax on expatriates, I mean, it is in a sense, and I'm not wishing to be, what's the right word? Whatever. It's somewhat trite to make comparisons with economies where you've got an unemployment rate of 2-3% or 5%, and ourselves where we're sitting at huge unemployment rates. So you've got expatriates who are not simply going abroad to earn more money, they're simply going abroad to survive because they can't get jobs here. And so I think the comparisons are useful, certainly. I suggest they're not. But I think there has to be more. What have we done any work to establish really what the kind of people are going to like Dubai? I mean, a lot of our nurses are working in Dubai. what's the reasons for those sort of people? I'm not too fussed with the high-end people, and they must look after themselves. But the kind of middle-class person who's, in a sense, forced to go and find employment elsewhere, and the impact on them is going to be, I mean, it's your own figures show it's going to be quite huge. Just the question is, you know, have we actually established the reasons for our people being abroad as opposed to citizens from countries where employment rates are high? In terms of the bargaining councils, which ones are involved, please? It's a very strange situation to have arisen with the bargaining councils that have been around for decades, and you know, where SARS been in all this time? This is a bit tongue-in-cheek with regard to the bursary exemptions, but you know, there's no question that people with disabilities have a greater barriers, financial barriers to cover, but there are different sorts of disabilities. Is there going to be a kind of graded, is it just you prove you're disabled because you've lost your right thumb and you get the higher amount? How is it practically going to work? In terms of the retirement age, the UK has just increased it to 68. Have we got any thoughts about increasing the retirement age? It's quite low at the moment, isn't it? Mr. Chairman, I think that's all. I'll cover me for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the first one regarding withholding taxes, it's not illegal. We've got a court case of PNR High Court judgment, whereby the court said the Minister of Finance, if the court found that it was not necessary.
Was there something you didn't get?
No, thank you, I'm fine.
She's unprecedented.
Yes,
we're given.
I'm confused, but never mind. Yeah, we'll go.
Okay, go on.
Okay, the court, it's not illegal, but we do not want to get into this argument again. But in the PNR case, the court said it is not necessary that exceptional circumstances must exist for Parliament to pass legislation retrospectively. So the court agrees with that in the judgment of PNR case. So as you have said, this is happening all over the world. It is not illegal, but we want to codify it into the law.
Yeah, and in a way, remember too that with tax, the rate is determined on your annual amount. So. Yeah. So until we don't reach that limit, we, you know, it's more the pace at which you're collecting. Yeah. I think just the issue on, and Chris can come in, but on the employment issue, I think the people who generally go and work out, I would guess, and I don't have evidence, but I would guess, are hardly the type of people who don't find employment here because they tend to be skilled. And if anything, Chris has reminded me here that when nurses leave at the time that you have nursing shortages, I mean, I think the medical industry is a different one where countries that produce still have a shortage because many other countries don't, like the UK perhaps or the US, don't actually train enough doctors for their own and nurses for their own society. Part of it is, I guess, these jobs may not attract people as much. So I'm not sure that analogy really holds. But I think having said that, look, we understand that measure is a strong one, and I think a lot of people who respond, like Chris has pointed out, don't really understand the impact on themselves, and we've got to separate those that are at the high end, clearly deliberately not declaring that they're no longer tax resident because they don't want capital gains to be triggered, with people who clearly are earning, say, below a threshold, okay? We're open for comments, so we're open to hearing what suggestions people come up with. And then we'll take a view on how to respond. Because part of it is also just the practicality of some of these measures. But certainly I think that the situation that you have, and I think when Chris says Middle East, basically the world is moving against tax havens. Now, while you have some islands that are close to us or the UK that are kept as tax havens, like Mauritius and so on, Virgin Islands or whatever, I think the Middle East itself, there seems to be no tradition of taxes being paid, because this loss of oil revenue, of course, that is sort of changing, but that does introduce, I think a lot of people go there because simply they earn much more, and they don't get taxed. So, you know, and how do you deal with this from a fairness perspective? And then I think that there are very different problems for people who go and operate in the rest of our continent, where there are, I understand, some admin issues that may come in as well. So it does, I mean, the major point I want to make is that's a proposal. Yes, it takes it to its logical conclusion about how the system should work. Chris has shown you the graphs to show you our own assessment of the impact, but we are keenly interested in getting the feedback, and we spend time on it because we understand it's quite a significant measure, maybe not so much from a revenue perspective, we don't know that, right, but certainly from the impact on people and the large numbers on Facebook that you see who are interested, we want to get the balance right, because look, it's also a good thing for young people to go out, you know, do a few years. They are CAs or doctors, and hopefully they come back. You don't want to disincentivize getting some sort of worldwide experience as well. So it's there are pluses and minuses. On the other hand, it could be a way that skilled people leave the country, which you also don't like. But you can't really, sometimes I think the best medicine for that is to ask, why are people leaving? What problem are they running away from? And can we fix up the problem that they're running away from? That's always the best way to solve the problem, rather than ban people and so on. But at the same time, we don't want our tax system to encourage something that I don't believe is certainly not in South Africa's total interest. We don't want to incentivize that. You want to at least make sure the system's neutral when people are making those decisions. You want to add?
Yeah, thanks. Just quickly on it. I mean, we do want to be very sensitive with people being able to make a living. I mean, just to note though that the unemployment rate amongst graduates and those with diplomas is much lower. It's below 10%. And just to be wary, I mean, a lot of people say because we can't get a job here, we've had to go overseas because we can't get a job there. But in reality, it's because they couldn't get a job that paid them enough for a lot of those people. And then they get a lot more overseas, and a large part of that is because they don't pay tax, overseas. And it's interesting that, in effect we're losing this revenue, and it does almost seem like an incentive for people to go, and maybe I'll just stop there. Thanks.
The second one regarding bargaining council, I think in terms of the Labour Relations Act, Section 28, there are about 40 bargaining councils that are registered there. So we're going to see when they come forward which ones are non-compliant.
Thanks. On the bursary exemptions, for the disabilities, we had just applied with we use the other definitions of disability in the Income Tax Act, the one specifically related to the medical tax credits. So no, we hadn't made distinctions from types of disabilities, and that's something that maybe we can look into and discuss. On the retirement age, you know, we don't have an official retirement age. The old age grant is at 60, but for most people, for people who are employed, it's really up to the firm. So I suppose government doesn't have as much of a say over that employment level, but of course it's something we can think about.
I mean, Chair, that is an issue, and you know, that's what we've tried to deal with in the broader retirement reform issue, because as people live longer, it helps that they delay taking on their retirement, and to the extent that if they have jobs beyond, say, 65, I think what we've been looking is that can we keep the system, can we tweak the system so that people can delay on retiring without getting punished, because many funds actually have rules that they force people to take their pension from a particular age. So we have introduced some measures, haven't we, already? So, you know, we are looking at tweaking so that if you choose to go that way, then you don't get this advantage. Other countries have taken stronger measures to say retirement age is 67 or 68. But I think that in our society, and just given the discussions on retirement, I think that the mortality rates for working people may be, you know, lower than people who have a you know, high income. Like an MP, yeah. So, you know, I think those are issues certainly when the retirement reform we've had to look at. So when it came to annuitization, people were saying, but look, mortality rates are lower, so therefore, you know, we are subsidizing the rich. Now, I think that's stretching the point. I don't think that's right, but one needs to take those points into account, I think, in a developing society like South Africa, and especially with the impact of HIV. But it needs a separate discussion. We'd love to come. I think retirement reform, even if it's not been done that actively, is being done in small measures until the NADAC process is completed. And that's why I say the issues of preservation, longevity, are really important issues for society. And the bigger issue, sorry Chair, you know, I'm taking advantage of this issue because I can go on this issue, is the so-called gig economy of vulnerable workers, where people no longer have one employer from 20 to 65, and they actually don't have pensions. So even in government, if someone comes and does work for us on contract, we don't force some form of auto-enrollment. We don't force them to deduct and put it into a pension fund or retirement fund, which is measures that I think we should begin to do.
Coming to general business taxes, as said in the budget, there was a proposal to give relief in respect of tax implications applying to debt relief in the current economic climate. Currently, the Income Tax Act makes provision for tax implication instances where the debt is cancelled or waived, depending on what have you used the loan for. So if you acquire a debt maybe to buy a capital asset, then what happens is that if now the debt is cancelled or waived, the amount of the debt that is cancelled will first reduce the base cost of such capital asset. So if the base cost is reduced, meaning that when you dispose of the asset at a later stage, then the capital gain will be higher. The second tax implication applies if you acquire a debt to fund operational expenses such as rental income. So when the debt is cancelled or waived, then there's going to be recoupment, reversal of income tax deduction in respect of that amount. So that's what happened. So, in the current economic climate, we found that the companies are in distress and the tax implications of the cancellation of debt are causing hardships to companies. So the first one is the mining companies. As you have said that the capital gains tax rules provided in paragraph 12A, whereby we said if you cancel a debt, it will reduce the base cost of an asset. It does not apply to mining companies. And the reason why it does not apply to mining companies is because Section 36 of the Companies Act, the capital assets of mining companies are treated differently from other companies. So that's why there was that. So the 2017 draft TILEP proposes that even though mining companies, the capital assets are treated differently, but the current general provision, which is paragraph 38, should also apply to mining companies. The second one is the debt relief for dormant group companies. Currently, paragraph 12A6 of the A schedule make provision for group companies to say that if a debt is between the group companies and that debt is cancelled, how in this scenario, between group companies, the amount of the debt that is cancelled is not going to reduce the base cost of the asset because we want to give relief for group companies. So that is what paragraph 12A6 is saying. However, the group company relief in paragraph 12A6 does not extend to apply to section 19 in cases where the debt was used to fund operational expenditure. So the taxpayers have come to us to say that in the absence of this relief, the absence of this relief creates technical impediment in cases where dormant group companies want to wind up. Because now they want the group companies dormant, and then they want to wind up, but this debt is going to be recoupment in terms of Section 19. So what we are proposing is that the provisions in paragraph 12A regarding capital assets should be extended to apply to Section 19 for group companies, but only for those dormant group companies, not only group companies, but only if the group company is dormant and wants to wind up, then those provisions will apply. The next one, what we have discovered in terms of SARS ruling application is that now the debt is not cancelled, but now instead of cancelling the debt, you issue shares in a company. So if maybe I owe debt in that company, instead of paying the debt, I issue you with the company share. And then this type of debt settlement often happens within the group companies, whereby you don't pay the debt but issue with the company shares in the company which you are owing the debt. It happens within the group companies. And then we are saying that that's what we have seen, and then they've applied for SARS ruling in this regard, whereby a conversion of debt into equity. So we are making legislation to say that if you convert your debt into equity, in this scenario, provided that it's within the same group of companies, then it will be allowed. However, any interest that has been deducted in respect of that debt will be recouped. The next one is the big one that made it to the articles on the same day of the budget and still now, addressing tax avoidance involving share buybacks and dividend stripping. Here we are happy in that, yes, they are saying that there was an anti-avoidance measure, but it's far-reaching. That is the proposals in the budget. Others are saying, yeah, this is the death of the share buybacks because people were using it to avoid tax. So it's different comments from different people. But what happens is that the Companies Act makes provision for companies to be able to buy back their shares. And then it was made in the Act to say that the proceeds from share buybacks will be regarded as dividends and not as capital gains and will be subject to a dividend tax of 20%. So what happens is that now the Income Tax Act, company-to-company dividends are exempt in terms of the Income Tax Act. So what happens is that now the current exemption of company-to-company dividends creates a loophole in the tax system in that now when they do the share buyback, they'll do it as dividends so that they get the company-to-company dividend exemption. And then several schemes have been identified where taxpayers structure their sale of shares using share buyback in order to get the proceeds as dividends, which are exempt in terms of capital gains, which are taxable at the rate of 22.4% for companies, a normal income tax in terms of 28. So, and then that was the first part. The second part regarding dividend stripping. In 2012, when we introduced dividend tax, we had anti-avoidance measures known as dividend stripping rules in Section 22B and Paragraph 43A. a dividend stripping occurs when a resident shareholder company that is a prospective seller of the shares, they avoid CGT by first declaring dividends before the sale of shares, because they know that the company-to-company dividends are exempt. However, when we made that provision in 2012, we said that if you do dividend stripping, it's going to be subject to tax, but provided that the pre-sale of dividends are indirectly funded by the prospective purchaser of those shares. So they were subject to tax provided that he funded the sale of shares. Next slide, please. However, we found that even though we have those rules before dividend stripping, however, the taxpayers are still entering into anti-avoidance schemes in order to avoid the current rules and also to use the share buyback. So now the 2017 draft TILAB proposes that the current dividend stripping rules in section 22B and paragraph 43A be extended, and also we address the issue of share buybacks. So now we've made one provision for both dividend stripping and share buybacks because it's difficult. Taxpayers will enter into this scheme using both anti-avoidance structure. As a result, the person now disposing of the shares in another company will be caught if that company is a resident, and the company disposing of the shares is holding at least 50% of the equity shares or voting rights, or 20% if no other person holds more than the other. And then you're going to be caught if you sell the shares within 18 months after receiving exempt dividends. Then the proposed amendment comes into effect on the 19th of July. And the reason why it comes on the date of the that 19th July was the date of the publication of the draft bill, because we wanted to stop the abuse. And we have seen from the comments that we are getting from taxpayers, others are saying, oh, we've already entered into transactions and all that. And then they knew that the transactions have got anti-avoidance measures. So that is. So we are receiving comments. We're going to see if we are far-reaching or not. And then we're going to take the comments. And then when we do the response, we're going to say what we're going to do. But it's so far so good, because even the tax practitioners are saying different comments. Others are saying, yeah, okay, we've done good. Others are saying, yeah, we've done good, but we are far reaching. So different. The next one is also an anti-avoidance measure for contributed tax capital. The income tax makes provision to say that a distribution to shareholder which leads to a reduction of CTC does not constitute dividend and is excluded from the distribution of dividends. However, because we have made that to say CTC distribution is not a dividend, now we've identified transactions in terms of which a South African subsidiary companies with foreign parent shareholder are increasing their CTC so as to avoid dividends. Because if you said it's a dividend, there's not going to be a withholding tax on dividends. But if you say CTC does not fall within the definition of dividend, so there's no withholding tax on dividends. So what happens is that these capital distributions are generally exempt from CGT, because a sale of shares is not subject to CGT if you are a foreigner, provided that the underlying asset is in respect of immovable property in South Africa. That's when you'll be subject to CGT in a sale of shares in a company. But if it's the sale of shares whereby the underlying property is not immovable asset, then there's no CGT. So we found that now there is a tax planning between a South African subsidiary which has got a foreign parent holding. Instead of paying dividends, whereby we'll be getting a withholding tax rate of 20% or reduced by the treaty to 5 and 10, now we're getting zero because they are structuring it as a CTC, contributed tax capital. So what we are saying in the 2017 draft TILAB is to say that if you structure in that manner, it will be regarded as a dividend. And then their legislation is in effect from 19 July 2017 because it is an anti-avoidance measure. I must say there's not lots of comments that we have received, because I think we have seen that they are doing anti-avoidance. The next one is the issue of in-supreme rule. Currently, the common law in South Africa has got a principle of in-supreme rule. And this is more than 100 years old. It was made to protect the debtors by providing that interest on a debt will cease to accrue once the total amount of the area interest is equal to the outstanding principal debt. So that is the common law principle. So we, in terms of the income tax, we found that taxpayers sometimes enter into loan arrangements whereby they give zero or low interest loan, and then the use of zero or low interest loan creates a loss to the fiscal, because maybe if it's an employer-employee relationship, there's no PAYE or else the Section 7 tax is due whereby you transfer assets to a trust. So in order to cap this, the income tax has got rules whereby if someone has used a zero or low interest loan, then it's going to be included in the income. For instance, if it's an employer-employee relationship, paragraph 11 of the 7th schedule and Section 7C, whereby you transfer assets to a trust. Now, it has come to our attention that the current anti-avoidance provision, whereby if it's a 7th schedule, you treat it as fringe benefit, may be undermined on the basis of the in-cuprim rule. Some taxpayers normally rely on the in-cuprim rule to distort the quantification of the tax benefit derived from this zero or low interest loan. And then they argue that there is no tax benefit in respect of the period during which the in-cuprim rule applies, as no interest can accrue or can be incurred during that period, because when you reach the interest, the interest stops running if it's equal to the principal amount of debt. Now, it is proposed that the current income tax rules will be clarified to say that though anti-avoidance measures apply in spite of the application of the in-cuprim rule, because the current anti-avoidance measures apply to address something else, loss to the fiscal, whereas the in-cuprim rule was meant to protect the debtor, so it's something else. The last one on the business tax issues, you may recall that in 2015 we made amendments in the SPT Act and Income Tax Act to give relief if a listed share or a government board is transferred in terms of a securities lending arrangement or collateral arrangement, and provided that share is brought within a certain period of time, is brought back to the lender within a certain period of time. So in 2016, we made amendments both to the SPT Act and the Income Tax Act to include listed South African government bonds. But we said when we made this amendment that we're going to explore to see if we're going to extend it to listed foreign government bonds. So the 2017 draft led extend this provision to apply to listed foreign government bonds. So this is going to assist. I think France is going to...
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
All right, so moving on to the taxation of financial institutions and products, and I suspect I'm handed this one, first of all, to give you a break from the Treasury voices, and second of all, because I happen to be an accountant, so I'm...
And you've been very quiet.
All right. So what we're seeing is, as accounting standards do, they evolve over time, and we're seeing the replacement of IAS 39 by IFRS 9. So as the starting point, we need to update our legislation simply to correct the references and to take account of the change in standards, so that's what we're doing. But we come to a more substantive issue, which is around the treatment of doubtful debts. Now, the tax system allows you to claim an allowance for debts that you think may be doubtful. So you haven't written them off yet, but you think there's a good chance that at some point in the future you may have to. And as a general rule, SARS will say, well, for that category of things that you're not sure about, we'll allow you a 25% allowance. So if you have 100 million of doubtful debts, we'll say 25 million is permissible as a tax allowance. Now, we've done something a little different for banks under IAS 39, where we've allowed a tiering. So there's a stage 1, stage 2, and stage 3, and we've permitted different percentages over those stages, starting at 25 and going up to 100%. Now, the problem with that is that IFRS 9 is more, shall we say, prudent or conservative, and it's much more aggressive about recognizing doubtful debts. So the problem then is that the percentage of SARS that is permitted in this context become way too generous. So we've had engagements with the banks to look at this, and because they're in a special space where they are regulated, the idea here is that for the early stage, you will emit a 25% allowance. But once you start getting into later stage doubtful debts, where there is a real appreciable risk of them becoming bad, we will step up from a 25% to 85%. Now, why 85%? Because based on our engagements with the banks, even if a debt is bad and is written, so they are recognizing it that they're not going to collect, they typically achieve a recovery rate on average of 15%. So 100 minus 15 gives you 85%. So we're saying for doubtful debt purposes, once you're into this later stage, we will permit an 85% allowance. And that should then assist the banks with us essentially over-recognizing what is doubtful for tax purposes. And that takes us to the SAM.
Okay, in terms of SAM, what happens that in 2016 we made certain changes to the Income Tax Act, Section 29 10A for long-term insurers in order to take into account the Solvency Assessment and Management Framework as well as the new Insurance Act. The new Insurance Act has not yet come into place. Although, I think the members will recall that when we were making the 2016 amendments, after the bill was tabled, we had to make other amendments after the bill was tabled based on the issues of SEP. And then what is happening is that although the 2016 amendments were explained clearly in the EM, however, some of the aspects of the legislation gave rise to uncertainty. So what we are doing in this year is that we're going to clarify the legislation so as to give clear policy intent to the legislation based on the EM. So that's what we're going to do. So they'll be happy with this because they were saying that the EM is not the law. Regarding tax, okay, are there any questions on those?
Chairman, I think we all just hold back until we've had the hearings and so on. And on the personal income tax, we've had a huge number of approaches, so consequently my questions earlier. But at this stage, I think on the company tax or whatever, we all just hold on for a minute.
Sorry,
no,
just a
no. I think we are still early on the discussion, and from what I've read, we're going to be engagement, consultation. I think that's where we will come back when we come back to that consultation, also on our public
hearing. Yeah, I think these questions are more questions of clarity.
Yes.
Because we probably understand. Thank you.
Okay, on the tax incentives, currently the Income Tax Act Section 18 cap A makes provision for donation to specialized agencies as defined in the Diplomatic Immunities Act to qualify for tax deductible donation. However, it has come to government's attention that the specialized agencies referred to in the Diplomatic Immunities Act do not include all the agencies of the UN operating in South Africa in terms of UNSA Strategic Cooperation Framework. So in order for us to incorporate all the UN agencies operating in South Africa in terms of the framework, proposed to be so that they can get tax deductible donations, proposals are made in this 2017 draft TLEB to make provision for all the UN agencies operating in South Africa in terms of the strategic cooperation framework to qualify for tax deductible donations. The next one is strengthening anti-avoidance measures relating to mining environmental rehabilitation fast. Okay, currently the Income Tax Act makes provision for contribution made to mining rehabilitation trusts and companies to be tax deductible, provided that those contributions are made for rehabilitation of the mine and those funds are used for the intended purposes. And if, according to the Act, if the funds are not used for that purposes, there are penalties that may be imposed in terms of the Act. So it has come to our attention that funds contributed to his trust and companies are being withdrawn and used to fund activities that are not related to the rehabilitation and closure of the mine, despite the current penalties contained in the Act. And in addition, the penalties provided in the Act are difficult to enforce due to the fact that they provide for the inclusion of the amount, depending on the nature of the contravention, in the taxable income of the mining company or the fund. And you find that by the time SARS is aware of the contravention, the mining company or mining rehabilitation fund does no longer have taxable income or is no longer there. So it's difficult to enforce. So in order to have provisions that are enforceable, the 2017 draft pillar proposes that amendments be made to penalty provision so as not to include it in taxable income, but it will be a straight penalty to say you pay penalty of a certain amount if you contravene. That is the first thing. Secondly, we make it as a reportable arrangement. Whenever you withdraw money from this, it's going to be a reportable arrangement in terms of the Tax Administration Act. Thirdly, the company must report yearly to the DG of Treasury if they withdraw money from their fund. So that's what we're going to do, so as to be aware of what this is. The next one, you are extending the scope of non-recoupment rules for venture capital companies. As you may be aware, the Income Tax Act contains rules to encourage investment into small and medium-sized enterprises and junior mining companies. And then what you are saying, that taxpayers who invest in VCCs will get an upfront deduction. And what happens is that if they dispose of the shares within the period of 5 years acquiring them, then there'll be a penalty. But if they dispose after 5 years, then there's no penalty. So what happens is that if you invest in a VCC, if you invest in any investment, you either get a dividend or a return of capital. So what happens is that if you get a dividend, everything is fine, but there's a problem when you get a return of capital, in that if you get a return of capital, then there's going to be a recoupment of deductions. So in order to level the playing field, you are saying that if you get a return of capital, then there's not going to be a recoupment of tax deduction, and the return of capital for this purpose will be treated the same as dividends.
Okay, the last one on incentives is on, it's called 12I, which is Industrial Policy Project Tax Incentives. So this provides a tax incentive for projects that are approved by the 12I committee. The current 12I exemption has already reached its limit of 20 billion, so no more approvals are currently taking place. But the sunset date was 31 December 2017. So this amendment is saying we're going to push that sunset date after 31 March 2020, so that it can still continue. At the moment, the DTI are, if there is a project that was granted the exemption but then falls away, that amount in effect goes back into the pot and they can grant another exemption. We've been chatting with the DTI about reviewing the incentive. We want to make sure that it's working correctly and that it's getting good value for money. And then once it's reviewed, we can move from there and take the recommendations from that review. But this gives us space to do that review and for the program to continue up until 2020.
The next one is international taxation.
Mr. Chairman, just on the 20 billion, is that this year's allocation?
No, so the 20 billion is in effect over the whole period of the program and related to the value of the tax expenditure, and the tax expenditure is actually a lot less than that at the moment because the projects haven't started and they haven't started taking place. So we do have it in our tax expenditure. I'm not going to say the exact number, but it's a lot lower, and so that amount should start being used up in the years to come. But the allocation, the deemed allocation has been reached.
The next one is international taxation. Here we are giving relief for domestic treasury management company regime. In 2013, we introduced a domestic treasury management company regime for exchange control purposes and tax purposes. And the regime was aimed at encouraging listed South African multinational companies to move their treasury operations to South Africa instead of Mauritius. Under this regime, listed South African multinational companies are allowed to establish one subsidiary in South Africa, their foreign currency, to manage the group treasury functions without being subject to exchange control restrictions that apply to companies incorporated in South Africa. And I think, as you are saying, that we saw a lot of companies moving to Mauritius to say that because of exchange control issues, so we wanted to ease that burden. So in order to qualify as a domestic treasury management company, a company must satisfy all the following criteria mentioned in the Income Tax Act. That is, it must be incorporated in South Africa and must have its place of effective management in South Africa and must not be subject to exchange control restrictions by virtue of being registered with the South African Reserve Bank. So in order to make this regime more effective, it is proposed that the requirement that the company must be incorporated in the Republic be removed, because even if it's incorporated offshore, but if it's effectively managed in South Africa, it will still be regarded as tax resident in South Africa. So we are trying to ease this.
Jim, thank you. Is there any indication that there will be any move back from, let's say, Mauritius, or is this just going to slow down the move to Mauritius?
I think we can only hope that they can move and come back, or maybe slow down in that way.
No,
the reason why we made this proposal, because they, when we call out for proposals before the end of the year, they bring this to our attention, and then we, yes.
Okay, the next one
is,
so, I mean, part of the thinking here is that permitting someone to bring back a company that is registered offshore would precisely assist in that regard. You don't have to register a new company in South Africa. You can bring back your offshore registered company into South Africa. So this is definitely aimed in that direction.
Currently, the income tax contains anti-avoidance measures. This is throughout the world, aimed at disallowing the deduction for payments made to a foreign person in respect of right of use of tainted intellectual property. And the main aim of this anti-avoidance rule is to prevent erosion of the South African tax base resulting from assigning South African intellectual property to foreign entities subject to a lower effective tax rate in that foreign country, followed by licensing that intellectual property back to South Africa. Because you want to pay royalties, the royalties will be regarded as a deduction, whereas the intellectual property was developed here in South Africa. Oh,
it's
really sensitive. Extended intellectual property is the one that is like, if maybe intellectual property was developed in South Africa, and you know that if you develop intellectual property, you get 11D R&D. And now what happens is that you get all that 150 deduction, and now you assign that intellectual property offshore, and you no longer make it a South African-owned intellectual property. You assign it offshore to a lower tax country, and thereby now, because the intellectual property is not yours, it's offshore, and you license it back to South Africa, and when you license it back to South Africa, the South African company will have to pay royalties now to that intellectual property, whereas the intellectual property was developed in South Africa. Yes. That is tainted intellectual property. Although the concerns that led to the introduction of the above-mentioned anti-avoidance measures are well understood, because this is issue-based erosion and profit shifting. However, when we received our comments last year regarding 2017 Annex Chancy proposals, we found that they are discouraging the use of existing South Africa-based infrastructure, whereby the minor maintenance is made in South Africa and yet is licensed elsewhere. So when we met with the companies, they say that because South Africa is desirable, it's good to make business in South Africa, they've got companies set up here in Cape Town whereby the IT specialists are here. So according to our provisions, even ongoing maintenance will be caught by these provisions. So what we are doing here, in order to address these concerns, we are proposing that the rules prohibiting the deduction of tainted intellectual property will not apply to a CFC if the CFC pays foreign taxes that are comparable to a South Africa. So let's say that if now you move the tainted intellectual property maybe to UK, and it's a South African CFC, then it will not apply. That's what it is. And the last one is extending the application of CFC rules to foreign companies held via foreign trusts and foreign foundations. As you know, South Africa taxes their residents on their worldwide income. So when we moved to worldwide income in 2001, we had CFE provisions, controlled foreign entity, but we changed them to controlled foreign company provisions. By having controlled foreign company provisions means that anything that is not a company which is controlled is excluded, meaning that a trust will be excluded. So since 2008, it has come to our attention that South African residents are interposing foreign trusts, and then that foreign trust will control the foreign company, thereby breaking the CFC rules. So what we are doing in this regard, we are bringing measures to say that if you are a South African resident, you control a foreign company, but you interpose a foreign trust or a foreign foundation. A foreign foundation is a foreign concept. You don't have foundations, I think, in South Africa. Then it will be caught under the CFC rules. We are having a lot of comments on this, and then maybe we're going to respond to the response document. I think that's all to international tax. Are there any questions? Okay, the next one is the VAT issues. The local government elections that took place on 3 August 2016 resulted in structural changes of municipalities. There was merger, some municipalities were disestablished. This affected municipalities because they have to cancel their VAT registration number or change their name in their VAT invoices. So in order to address unintended consequences as a result of the structural changes, we are making transitional measures in the VAT Act in order to address this issue. And then the next one, clarifying the VAT treatment of leasehold improvements. Currently, the VAT Act does not provide guidelines in respect of the VAT treatment of leasehold improvements done by the lessee on the leasehold property during the period of the lease. And the thing is that the Income Tax Act has got special provisions in Section 11F regarding this. The lack of clarity in the VAT Act has led to inconsistencies in the VAT treatment, because now if you are a VAT vendor, you don't know whether to treat this as a taxable supply or not a taxable supply. So it is proposed that amendments will be made in the VAT Act to clarify that leasehold improvements by a lessee on leasehold property during the period of a lease will be regarded as taxable supply and subject to certain conditions. And then the last one.
Before the last one, yeah. I just want to find out if the maybe a proposed deadline in as far as the transition is concerned on the issue of the municipalities to changing their VAT and other issues. Is there a proposed time frame
whereby they have to comply?
Yes.
No, what we have done, because we know that it is not their own doing, it is a result of the structural issue, but we've made changes to the legislation retrospectively to allow for that, for the time from the 3 August 2016. It's just open.
Currently,
the VAT Act makes provision for insurance and the arranging of insurance related to international travel to be zero rated. However, the zero rating provisions do not extend to insurance cover provided during the period that the insured is transported to and from the insured's original point of departure, that is when they are en route at the airport, and not physically transported while on the international journey, while the insured stays at the hotel. Let's say if you are en route, maybe you are going to Chile, but you stay in a hotel, maybe in Portugal, that scenario. So in order to address these practical concerns, because that is still, you are part of en route on international travel, even if you stay one day at a hotel or 45 hours or at the hotel. So in order to address those concerns, it is proposed that zero rating provisions pertaining to insurance cover provided as part of international travel journey be clarified to include en route when you are at the airport, when you are still waiting. So those are the issues.
That is the end of the income tax
amendment. That is Section 77 money bill. Now we're going to get to Section 75.
Right, and that pushes over to SARS because this is where we're most closely involved. So you'll see it's under four distinct headings: the Income Tax Act, the Customs and Excise Act, the Administration Act, and Customs Duty Act. You may wonder why you're seeing tax administration issues in the Income Tax Act, and that's a design choice that was made back in the days when the Tax Administration Act was developed. The Tax Administration Act covers all the generic principles, but there are certain principles which are very closely tied to a particular tax act, and trying to put them in a single piece of legislation would have been very, very difficult, because you almost have to repeat a whole bunch of substantive legislation in the specific piece of legislation in your generic legislation, and then you can get to the meat of the matter. So there are tax administration aspects which are very closely tied to a particular tax act in that tax act, and then the generic provisions live in the Tax Administration Act. So I hope that explains why you're seeing this happening, and not just, you know, the Tax Administration Act showing up. And so let's start with the Income Tax Act. And here what we're dealing with is we have a special rule. It's essentially a turnover tax. I'm getting to the second one already. So let's start with the first one. We have a situation where SARS may adjust a tax return that goes back a year or two. And we say perhaps that you owe us less and we need to pay you interest. Now, strictly speaking, in accordance with the Income Tax Act, what you then mean to do is reopen the subsequent years for the accrual of the interest that occurred for those historical years. And that can get a little complicated. So one adjustment by SARS can result in you having to reopen a couple of subsequent years to declare the additional interest you've earned. So essentially what's being proposed here is when SARS notifies you that you have more interest that you have, you can bring it into account in that year and you don't have to make historical adjustments. So that should make life a little easier for taxpayers and hopefully be welcomed by them. Moving on to the second one, which is the turnover tax. We have a special turnover tax system for companies with a turnover up to R1 million. Essentially is a much easier system that you can work with. You don't have to worry about deductions. But the problem arises when you transition from that system into the main tax system. Maybe you got your provisional tax payment wrong because you were on the turnover tax system, now you're in the main system, perhaps accessing the Small Business Corporation concession. And so strictly speaking, we should impose a penalty on you because you got your provisional tax wrong. This makes it clear that we will not do so. So if you've been taken out of the one and moved into the other, and the only reason you have a penalty is because of that transition, the penalty will fall away. So it'll assist people growing their businesses. Then we get to some truly practical issues. Currently we have a table which is released on an annual basis that tells you the costs you may deduct with respect to motor vehicle travel. The problem here is that table works on an annual basis, but what happens if you are given a rate per kilometre on a monthly basis? What rate do you use? Because you can only work out some of the rates if you wait until the end of the year. So what we're doing as a practical proposal is we're saying there is a rate that is set in that annual notice, which is of general application. It's a simplified rate, and we're saying for purposes of working out your employees' tax, use that simplified rate just for the monthly deductions. So employers should find that a lot easier. They don't have to sort of keep a running total anymore. There's a simple single rate that they can use, and it should make their lives somewhat easier. We've had discussion on retirement funds a little earlier in the session today, and there is a cap of R350,000 on what you can contribute to retirement. The question then is, can I use the whole R350,000 in the first 3 months of the year and then, you know, the devil take the hindmost for the other 9 months? Or how does it work? And the Act is silent on that at the moment, so the proposal here is apportion that R350,000 cap over the duration of the year. Why? because you may change employment halfway through the year. And how's your second employer meant to know what the first employer did? So this just ensures that there is a monthly amount, 350,000 divided by 12, that is applicable in each month, and that makes it easier if there is a change of employment during the course of the year. And then finally, on this slide, dividends are included in remuneration under certain circumstances. So under those circumstances, pay as you earn should be deducted, and we're just making that clear. We then get to the Customs and Excise Act for the first time, Customs and Excise, and the reason we come to Customs and Excise twice is because we're in a transition period at the moment. We have the 1964 Act, and then we have the new 2014 Act, so we have to manage both systems simultaneously. And so we start with the Customs and Excise Act 64, which is currently in operation, and there we have secrecy provisions. Government has restructured since those secrecy provisions were first, were last amended, and so we're opening up some of the disclosure for government to be able to use trade statistics and work out trade policies, and we're extending those to the Economic and Development Department, so we can provide them with statistics. And then with respect to the Reserve Bank, we're ensuring that all the regulations relating to exchange control are covered, as opposed to just the 1961 regulations. A matter that some members will be aware of is that we're wishing to de-link the diesel refund system from the VAT Act, and so we're underpinning that in the customs and excise legislation, which is where the diesel refunds take place. We're breaking that linkage so that once we have the new system in place, we don't have to run them together. Right, that brings us to the Tax Administration Act. And the first item, this flows from hearings on the legislation last year that dealt with the mineral and petroleum, MRPDA, Mineral Petroleum Development Resources Royalty Act, Administration Act, where it was noticed that there was a particular kind of decision SARS could take that was not subject to an expedited internal revenue, where SARS can reconsider a decision that relates to the change in an estimate for what is essentially a provisional tax payment. This ensures that that low-cost remedy is available. What is the low-cost remedy? Essentially, if you have a difficulty with the decision, you can come back to SARS and ask the person or the person's manager to reconsider the decision and relook at it. And we're making sure that that is available under those circumstances. Then we get to interest. We have a transitional rule. We have a 2011 Act, and we're still dealing with transitional issues. Here we have people who are looking at the precise wording and saying, well, we're still not entirely sure the exact wording covers this aspect. So we're making it clear that the interest on an understatement penalty works the same way as the interest on an additional tax penalty would have under the old. So really, they serve the same purpose. An understatement penalty is the same as an additional tax was under the old system. So the same interest rules should apply, and we're making that absolutely clear. And then the Tax Administration Act proposes a single consistent interest regime for all tax types. Now, at the moment, we have different interest systems for the different tax types, and that's a legacy. They have different they have different IT systems they are running on, and the idea is to move them over and get them consistent so taxpayers have one single system they need to deal with. Of course, that is difficult to achieve in practice precisely because we're running on different IT systems, and so it would make sense rather than trying to do them all at once, let's do them as we move each tax type across, and that is what is being proposed here. But instead of having one switch over from all the different interest systems to the new system, we can do it on a phased basis. Would have been ideal to switch them all over immediately, but practically you just can't do it because of all the different legacy systems we have. And then finally we come to the new Customs Acts. Here we're in the process of dealing with the preparation for turning on these new acts, And so let me deal with the last bullet on that slide first. As you can imagine, there are a number of sets of rules and regulations that are issued in terms of the customs legislation. It's a very rule-driven environment, and that is true internationally. And so what we're proposing here is that we be permitted to, in fact, publish those rules and begin processing applications under those rules prior to the acts being turned on, so that there's a transitional period where people can, in fact, get their applications approved prior to the legislation coming into effect. This is, in fact, not strange to South African law. There's something virtually identical in Section 14 of the Interpretation Act of 1957, but that's a general provision, and here we're making it specific to the kinds of rules we're dealing with in the Customs Duty and Customs Control Act. So just giving industry the comfort that we will have the ability to process their applications prior to the systems going live. Then back onto the first, as we work through systems developments and the preparation of rules, we pick up issues. This particular bullet deals with clamping down on potential for fraud and irregularities around refunds. So what this set of amendments proposes is that it is the person who made clearance of the goods who is entitled to the refund. So we're making sure it goes back to the person who's entitled to it, not somebody else. But, and this is an important but, that person can authorize someone else to receive the refund on their behalf, but it's got to be properly documented. So we don't have a loss of a sort of internal chain of control as to who got the refund and why. So you can't have someone sort of stepping into the process and claiming a refund that they're not entitled to. It's got to be properly authorized. And that is true of the second bullet, practical issues we've picked up. So to take the first sub-bullet, the general rule, which works very well in the commercial environment, is that various reports need to be given to us after the vessel has departed. And in a commercial environment where the commercial operator has access to our electronic interfaces, that's great, they love it, because they can give us those reports. But if you're a single operator of a private vessel, you probably don't have that infrastructure, and so you would prefer to give us the report before you leave. And so we open the window for you to do so. And we also open the window for you to give us that as a manual report rather than an electronic one. And that is true equally for the second. Again, just some practical issues that are picked up. There's certain mandatory information that is not always required, so we open up the ability to exempt people from providing us that mandatory information. And then the final sub-bullet there, which is the transshipment of goods, is quite important in the Kucha Port Elizabeth context, because transshipment of goods, some of our provisions assume that you're dealing with a single port, but those two ports are actually very close together, and you may have to transship goods by road between them. And so we open up the window to do that, which is quite important for the government's work around improving Kucha as a transshipment hub. So these are essentially issues we're picking up as we're in the process of preparing for the implementation of the Act, and so we are loosening where necessary and tightening where necessary. So hope that assists.
There is one proposal which was in the budget but not in the TLEP. In the 2017 budget review, the following announcement was made, whereby in 2016 amendments were made in the Income Tax Act to provide for an exemption from donations tax and capital gains tax on land reform initiatives as outlined in Chapter 6 of the National Development Plan. As members are aware, during the public hearings last year, there were people from Wittenberg Pearls who came to Parliament in the public hearings regarding this. And then they advised Parliament that they donate land to a company or to a trust. It's not like outright donation to individuals. So we should cater for that. So we put that proposal in the budget announcement for the 2017, in the budget review. However, we made consultation, we had meetings with the taxpayers, and we consulted with the Department of Land reform, rural development and land reform on this matter. And then they advised that they are still busy with the MOU and the policy paper between them and the Wittenberg PAF. Once the MOU is signed, then it is then that we can make amendments in the tax act, because it will depend on what is going to be in the MOU. So what we propose is that we delay this amendment, even though it was announced in the budget, until such time the process of the MOU is finished with the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform and the stakeholders involved.
And Chair, there's one more slide on the health promotion levy if you wanted an update, but I don't know if we can wait till Momo gets back if you want to give you an update and the committee an update on that. Okay. So the committee did send a letter through to NEDLAC asking to try to complete their proceedings as quickly as possible to help the committee give guidance on their decisions. So Labour and Government, National Treasury met with the Executive Director Secretariat on the 11th of July. Labour and Government both gave an indication of the support for the proposed independent study to the Secretariat on the 11th and 12th of July. Business responded at the NEDLAC task team meeting on the 4th of August. So we, government, has then convened an interdepartmental committee. So we had Treasury, EDD, Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, DTI, and Labour to develop a mitigation plan. So that plan was presented to NEDLAC and is currently under consideration. NEDLAC did convene yesterday on the issue. So we hope to complete the process within NEDLAC in the next week. And then that submission will go to the NEDLAC chamber, which then needs to be processed through the NEDLAC chamber. So there could be agreement here, but it looks unlikely that there will be independent research done within the timeframes that are required. So we are proposing that the independent research be part of an impact study and monitoring and evaluation exercise, but that the NEDLAC report be finalized, completed, to go through the chamber, and is then given to the committee so that the committee can then look at the report as is. So there was some delays in that independent research. But Momo is back. Momo, I don't know if you want to talk about the HPL
study.
I think, Chair, we've really made good progress within NEDLAC. And I think there's a lot of confusion. Firstly, not just from this process, but I think that at the policy conference, the initial wording created the impression that there was a call to delay. The wording got, I believe, when I looked at that wording was removed, so there's no call to delay this, the health levy. But the way it was put was it should also go to NEDLAC. So there seems to be, I know this is not coming from the members, but it's been raised. So just to be clear, there's no call for it to be, I think the word was, held in abeyance. That was removed. And the issue is that it should go through the NEDLAC process. So I guess what we wanted to show is everybody's saying take it through the NEDLAC process and see what progress you've made. So that's consistent with what the committee had asked. Mr. Karim then had asked that in the last meeting of this committee on the rates bill, you had asked that this matter be that NEDLAC complete its process, but had also asked for an independent review. He then asked NEDLAC if it could effect that. Now, the NEDLAC process, what we want to show, was very slow. And frankly, to be honest,
when you discuss any tax issue, there's no incentive for other parties, especially if you're going to be affected by the tax, to hurry things up. So you take your time over certain issues, okay? And that's why we've been very clear that when it's a tax matter, government should never, and Parliament should never make itself subject to any process in that. Like, you can take their views into account as long as they deliver by a certain date. If they don't deliver by a certain date, I would argue that Parliament must exercise its discretion, because tax processes can take forever if you leave it to consultation. As I say, you cannot consult Turkey's folk over Christmas, okay, to put it bluntly. Tax does have an element of coercion, and at some point you have to make the final decision. But that's a general discussion on tax, not specific to this issue only. So we've made real progress, and I think the key point is this, and the clarity we wanted is, you know, there's as you know, there's a lot of economic studies that have gone into it, and there's a kind of view that and let the parties come and say, but our hope is to say, if this committee can just look at its request for that independent study, if that can be, you know, if we reach agreement, I'm not sure you really need that independent review. It's rather, because even that won't provide any certainty. But what we've agreed with the parties is that the sugar industry is generally under stress. There's a whole lot of other issues. And I think the great break we've made is we've actually managed to get government coordinated by having the key departments coming, including agriculture, and they are looking at a whole lot of proposals. And we're sort of getting to an agreement, but it's not finalized yet, but we're getting to a proposal that with the mitigation plan that we've been discussing there, that there would be some joint process with the industry and labor that will monitor the impact and kick in certain things. So, for example, if people get laid off, in terms of our labor laws, they have certain protections. That kicks in. UIF kicks in. So there's various types of support. And then more generally, the structural changes that agriculture is looking at will also come in. So when we come for the bill, we'll explain that. We'll have the rest of the team. But I think we just wanted clarity on, you know, the key point was that NADLEC's not going to be able to really deliver, I think, what Mr. Karim has requested, that they do the independent study or review that was requested. So, and we were hoping that you have a more flexible approach on that if there is agreement within NADLEC. Because we've said that will continue to be done as we monitor implementation.
Okay, let's just deal with the funds quickly so we can put this away. And this is not the main item on the agenda.
It's not for the
bill. It's a report back. But I think the reason for a preference for it to go to NADLEC, not that it's necessarily a compulsory measure, but obviously there are conflicting interests here. One, you know, there's a very serious health issue and the health concerns, and the other one is the issue of possible job losses and the impact on industry. And there, you know, and it seems like, you know, almost a stalemate there, because and it seems like there may have been, clearly, as it happens, there's lobbying by the health sector, and there's lobbying by the sugar industry, and this lobbying does reach members, unfortunately. And so that's the way it is. So I don't think one can escape it. But because these concerns are there, I think the first prize has been a mediation process where labor and government and industry can find each other, government having a particular interest, not a revenue interest, but a health interest, yes. And then obviously industry having concerns. And if the two could meet through this forum called NADLEC, that would obviously be first prize. But if they can't, and they can't find each other, as I understand it, as the Kaledi is no longer here, there's time pressure, I'm afraid. So we can't just let it go forever. At some point, we have to make a hard decision. And obviously, if NEDLAC were able to come to agreements, it would have helped us. Would have helped us enormously to make the hard decision. So I think, you know, I'm sorry that Eunice isn't here, because I think we have to make a call on this. NEDLAC clearly is not going to be able to do this on time, but it's an independent study. And when do you say it would be independent study? The result of this independent study be available?
So the way they're saying is that NEDLAC's not going to do that, but I think they accept that given all the studies, the issue is to do an independent review as you have implementation, because there are other challenges as well in the sugar industry. So they want to, so the kind of agreement that we are saying is let's do that as part of the process of monitoring. Okay. Just bear in mind, Chair, as well, that at NEDLAC, because it takes place in a task team, whilst our colleagues from the Department of Health have been attending, but the health academics don't have a way of participating in the NEDLAC process. Okay, so, but despite that, I think that we are getting, I'm optimistic. We even had a meeting yesterday, that we are actually getting an agreement, and when we come, we will be able to present something coherent.
Thanks, Chairman. So just no detail, but the mitigating plans, are they in any way a tax implication? The proposal says that.
No, from what I can see, there's a lot of mechanisms that are already there in government to deal with this. There's even funds on budgets. So we currently, and EDD is sort of helping to lead in this, they actually have been able to tap all the various mechanisms that there are already in government. Of course, the complaint is government's not coordinated, there's timing issues. So, for example, and let me give you an example, there's the issue of also alternate uses and alternate crops. So there are programs for that. On alternate uses, some of it, like biofuels, okay, you know, the low oil price doesn't help. So you know, some of these things are just economic realities that you have to take into account. It's not that there's no progress. So I think the mitigation plan kind of, you know, answers a lot of those questions. And I think everybody in the process appears to be happy that they, and I think there was a legitimate concern from the other parties that government's not coming with a coordinated position. Where is the other departments? And I think I'll be quite happy to see that there's an active subcommittee, in a sense, in government that's meeting. And it does appear that even industry and labor are certainly, I'm not saying that they're going to approve everything. Let the plan be finalized and then we can report. But I'm optimistic that we are getting to an agreement.
Okay, well, obviously it would be preferable if government itself could speak with one voice, and
yes,
that it would be dealt with. That it could be dealt with through one of the clusters. We're not here. We've not been confronted with a government department presenting us with a case other than another government department. You've been presenting the case on behalf of, obviously, tabled by health because of legitimate health concerns. We are not aware. You've been part of the process earlier. We're not aware of the Department of Agriculture coming in with any opposition to it, which would be most unfortunate, obviously, because then government is not speaking with one voice. What we are aware of is that Labour has spoken here, Kusatu has made a presentation, the industry has made their presentation, and those are the ones that we're listening to. But if you can mediate, if you are able to, and obviously it's very encouraging, that you seem to be getting to the point where you're finding some kind of formula that would at least have to be monitored as you go along, but that would keep parties relatively happy. Nobody's going to be completely happy with this because they are conflicting interests.
Just to give you an example, like business law is part of the deal, they must come and support the sugar tax. And we said to them, we don't expect you to sign any document that you support any tax. We understand you may be committing suicide if you do that, but it's just for people to know that, you know, that the tax is there. So, yeah.
Well, I think we just take this as an encouraging report back, actually. Thank you. To go back to the real matter on hand, any kind of questions or comments on the entire presentation or presentation?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just a few that I've picked up as I go along, and I'm sorry I'm going back to personal income tax, but in 2014, I think, the Minister announced that the means tests for the old age pensions would be done away with, but I don't see anything yet on that one. I think it was 2014. You're looking at me as though the means test for the old age pension.
Oh, yes.
So, and then the charity, the 350,000 spread over the 12 months, but that doesn't, you know, you move from one employer to the next employer, you haven't used up the 350,000 in the first employer, but the 350,000 has been spent. And the next employer, there's nothing. I mean, what I'm trying to say is the 350,000 is for the year. That it's not on a monthly basis. It's an annual thing. Okay. So the nodding your heads, I think you guys understand what I mean. And Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased about the diesel refund being separated. Although I'm not sure whether that now will require an additional return. So that's additional administration for the taxpayer, and how it's going to fit into the IT system, which for years we've been talking about getting all these different systems into a system which talk to each other. So just some reassurance about the how it will actually work and not put an additional burden on taxpayers. Then the interest rate regime between these different systems, what you're not saying, France, is that we're going to implement the lowest from every system. Because that's what we want to hear, but how is the determination going to be made? And then the whole Customs Act thing, when does that move to Home Affairs, away from us? Or am I misunderstanding what we're talking about here? And I'm just curious, I'm sorry, I don't know if I wasn't listening properly with regard to the transshipment issue. Who is this MOU with? No, not the transshipment, sorry, that's the land issue. The transshipment, I was curious about, we're talking about Kuka, and it's really very underutilized, as I understand it. And so it's great that we make provision for it to work better. But, I mean, is a transshipment from Cape Town Harbour to by road to Kuka, and then loaded onto another ship? What is the transshipment? Was it just Port Elizabeth Harbour? What are we talking about there? And then to get to the land reform issue. I mean, I think this is an urgent thing because there's a lot of a will for people to be involved in land reform, and this whole issue of the capital gains tax is restricting it. And so I'm not sure where the MOU covers it.
So allow me to begin. So on the pay-as-you-earn question and the 350,000, you're quite correct. That is the annual limit. The 350,000 divided by 12 is purely for pay-as-you-earn purposes. So to take the rather strange example where somebody contributed 350,000 in the first month, 6 months, or the first month, and then in the rest of the year contributed nothing in under the new employer, that would be balanced out in the final assessment for the year. So that is taken care of. With respect to interest, I couldn't possibly say we're going to go with the lowest, because there are all these oddities that sort of date back for decades. So for example, in some of the tax acts, you pay interest on a monthly basis. So if you're a day late, you pay interest for a month. So that's problematic. So the model that we're moving to in terms of the Tax Administration Act is a much more commercial model. It's interest that's calculated on a daily balance, and at some point it will be capitalized monthly, although that doesn't have to be switched on immediately. But it becomes a much more logical system, which is then tied into the repo rate. With respect to the Border Management Agency, that's completely separate from the Customs Duty Act and the Customs Control Act. That would relate to the performance of certain functions in terms of those acts, but it doesn't detract from the fact that SARS remains the administrator of those acts. In broad terms, what would change in the BMA model is who administers at a port of entry. So that's the distinction, and that's a separate debate from what we're doing here. But a very important one. The transshipment point, the idea here is this is primarily of use for transshipments that occur sort of starting in PE going through Kucha or vice versa, but it's not limited to that. So potentially it could be transshipments that start somewhere else and end up at Kucha, or start at Kucha and end up somewhere else. But the driving sort of need that made this clear was the very close proximity of Port Elizabeth and Kucha as ports.
The land reform one, Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, before the land has to be transferred to that entity which is a trust or a company, they said that there are valuations that needs to be done to check if the land is arable or not, and the ownership that the transferor of land will have in that trust or a company, because the community must have majority of shareholding. So those are the issues. So once those agreements are in place and the MOU is signed between the Department of Land Reform and those people, that's when the MOU will be our basis, because it will tell what will be the structure. The transferors of land, the example here was Wittenberg Pearls here in Cape Town, farmers that are transferring land to communities.
Okay, it's a multiple MOU.
It's a multiple MOU. But maybe there will be one MOU which will guide, which will be a guiding MOU in terms of the land transfer to a trust or a company, and then multiple MOUs will be formed out of that principal MOU.
Yeah, from our perspective, we're just worried about potential avoidance, because if you're now giving this tax treatment to a trust, but then we're not exactly sure who the trustees are, who the beneficiaries are, there could be a small portion of it that goes to the community, but a large portion of it goes to his family. We looked at some of the structures, and then there were different structures, so we're just being careful on this. We really want to do it, and we've already done it in the last couple of years where we've said full outright transfer, receive no donation tax, no capital gains tax. Now we're just trying to work out partial transfers, but we're just trying to be careful while we do it as well.
If I may, it's not a new concept, because it's been in the Restitution Act for, I don't know how long, long time. So all the restitution agreements, those transfers didn't pay any donations or capital gains. So from that point of view, was there historically a lot of evasion or avoidance taking place,
So in those ones, and the ones that we made amendments last year, it was when the land is transferred to the community, not to an entity. In this scenario, the land is transferred to a trust or a company, and the transferor of land... In that scenario, it was like the outright transfer, and the transferor of land does not have shares in that company or trust. In this scenario, the farmer transfers land to a company or a trust, but the farmer has shares in that company, and there's a management company that does mentorship and training. It's a completely different scenario. So that's where now there are issues of anti-avoidance.
The issue of the means test, obviously, with retirement reform, that would be, I think, what we would want. But currently, affordability is an issue, so that. So that's what I think we last said. But even the process of retirement reform has slowed down considerably, as you know. So until we resolve issues within NEDLAC.
I think that more or less brings us to the end of our questions, and I think if we can just then get clarity on the process, as we said earlier on, the next step, as far as I know then, is the 29th, an all-day opportunity for the public to make their submissions, and we do our hearings on the 29th. Is there any... I mean, clearly you've also gazetted these drafters, am I right?
Not gazetted, we only get claims.
Yeah.
So what we do, Chair, is we just put it out on our website.
On your website.
The tax community knows exactly what to do, and I think just Mr. Lee's point earlier, a lot of these proposals, you yourself can't make up your mind. You're hearing our intention, and you've got to wait for the 29th when you hear the impact. And then you should obviously be making up your mind when you've heard all the sides, and that's where the response document comes in. So the key issue is the 29th, those hearings. Sometimes it may even take you 2 days, isn't it? It depends how many come forward. But it's important that gets completed. But at the same time, as they come in, we already look at it and even engage with certain players to understand them, because they send it to us directly as well.
Okay, 29th in any event is what is it? Two weeks from now. Should be, this is really a matter for the committee. At the moment, there's a date set aside. Should we not provisionally, in the event that we can't have it all on Monday, just to provisionally include another possible day, should we not be able to?
Chair, I think you're correct. We're just talking to Mr. Lee here to say, looking at the interest, the attention that the process is drawing, even though there's been this engagement at NEDLAC, we need to provisionally prepare for 2 days, taking from the experience, the 2 years, you know, experience that we have, so that we can give enough time to all the participating interested.
Okay, so we set aside another day. We try and do it in 1 day if it's possible. And then I think the important thing is our own deliberations, right? And so have we set aside an opportunity for that? Just to recap, so the deadline, really, when is the medium-term budget policy statement? Mid-October?
It's October, but it only has an indirect effect. For us, the race is to November, okay, when Parliament, when...
We go on Monday.
Yeah, before and before the NCOP closes. So in terms of our response, if you had that on the 29th, and again, it needs to be within a few days after that, we will then be able to time our response document towards the second or third week of September, then.
Yes, maybe.
Okay, so mid-September, we'd like to have the response document, and that gives us enough time then to amend the bill, which also then takes a few weeks. So we try and do that around the time of MTPPS if we have the revised bill table.
Okay. The bottom line, we could be ready to act very soon after we do the hearing. Well, thank you very much for the meeting. Thank you.
Follow whatever the model wants for additional text, and that may follow. if there was no interest, then there still is no interest. But otherwise, we're forcing system people to come in. But that is why we have to make the change in the world.
Yeah.
The heterogeneous
on religion.
So if historically there was no interest in additional texts, we preserve it. If there was interest in additional texts, we preserve it. But we don't create an interest where there was none before. Because that's what we did with the USP and our people that you pick it up.
I know.
I should be very careful because otherwise we'll be straight back in the VX next year saying. You know the transition. Speedy recovery.
Because one of the students.